live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, hundreds rallied in the town of Newburgh as town leaders unanimously opposed a proposed ICE detention warehouse leased by the federal government without local officials' knowledge. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was there and joins us with the latest. Could a last-minute amendment in Congress weaken the Delaware River Basin's long-standing fracking ban? Environmental groups say a proposal tied to a federal water infrastructure bill could undermine protections for the watershed. We'll get the latest about what's at stake and why advocates are sounding the alarm. And the historic Calicoon Depot will be buzzing with activity this weekend. We'll preview the free Birds and Bees event, and we'll meet the folk Americana duo Haunted Like Humid. That's all coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. U.S. military officials say their forces successfully struck military targets across Iran again last night. The statement said the strikes were designed to further degrade Iran's ability to attack commercial shipping. NPR's Jackie Northam reports the U.S. and Iran are attempting to exert control over the Strait of Hormuz.
Since the start of this crisis, Iran has claimed it's in control, and it's insisted ships get permission and follow approved rules, and it's attacking ships if they don't. On Monday, President Trump pushed back, saying that going forward, the U.S. will be known as the guardian of the Hormuz Strait, and he threatened to start charging 20% fees on all goods transiting through the waterway, even though his administration has said charging fees violates international law. Iran lashed out at this, saying under no circumstances will it allow the U.S. to interfere with the management of the strait.
NPR's Jackie Northam. The South African government says it's deported or repatriated more than 50,000 undocumented migrants amid a crackdown on illegal immigration. Kate Bartlett has more.
About 53,000 undocumented migrants, mainly from Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique, have been deported in the past month, according to government figures. But thousands of migrants from those African countries are also fleeing on their own accord, fearful of weekly xenophobic protests that have sometimes turned deadly. A populist group called March on March is leading the charge against migrants, blaming them for taking South African jobs amid an unemployment crisis. Thousands of Zimbabweans have also gone to the border, waiting to be repatriated, and thousands of Malawians have been camped out in the open, waiting for government-facilitated buses to take them home. Kate Bartlett, NPR News, Johannesburg.
The Labor Department reports inflation is slowing. Consumer prices rose 3.5% last month, compared to a 4.2% annual rise in May, a three-year high. The slowdown is attributed to lower prices for gasoline. The federal government is running a bigger deficit this year than it did last year. NPR's Scott Horsley has more in the story.
Federal tax collections are up this year, but federal spending's growing even faster. 9 months into the fiscal year, the government's more than $1.3 trillion in the red. Just paying interest on the government's accumulated debt has cost more than $1 trillion in the last 9 months. That's more than the government spends on almost any other single program, with the exception of Social Security. Tariff revenue has declined since the Supreme Court struck down the president's most sweeping import taxes. The administration is working to impose new tariffs. In the meantime, the latest report from the Treasury Department shows the government has paid more than $80 billion in refunds for tariffs that were collected illegally. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. New York today became the first state in the union to impose a moratorium on permits for large new data centers. Governor Kathy Hochul signed an executive order to ban them for up to a year to protect the environment and the energy grid. The facilities require huge amounts of energy and water to cool thousands of computer servers. Technology companies need them for artificial intelligence, prompting a backlash in communities. The number of pedestrians killed on U.S. roads has declined for the third year in a row. But as NPR's Joel Rose reports, fatalities are still well above pre-pandemic levels.
Drivers struck and killed just over 6,700 people last year, a drop of 7% from the year before, according to a report from the Governor's Highway Safety Association. California alone accounted for more than half of the drop. 2025 marked the third straight year that the number of pedestrian fatalities has declined since peaking in 2022. But last year's number is still 10% higher than the total from 2016. The report also looked at why and when pedestrians are killed and found some familiar patterns. SUVs, pickup trucks, and vans account for more than half of pedestrian deaths, and more than three-quarters of fatalities happen after dark. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
At this hour, the bidding opens in New York for Gus. It's a Tyrannosaurus rex discovered in South Dakota's Badlands 67 million years after it roamed the Earth. Scientists spent years documenting and reconstructing it. Sotheby's estimates it could sell for as much as $30 million. The bidding starts at $19 million. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Joining us in the studio now, Radio Catskills, Kimberly Izar. Hi, how are you?
Hey, Tim. Good morning.
Good morning. We're going to give folks a quick update on our summer fun drive. I don't know if you've checked recently. But
no, where are we?
We're at 69% of our goal, which
is amazing. Yay.
Wait, I only have the Mario sound.
I like that.
That's kind of fun.
It is fun. it's nostalgic.
The other bell broke. We rest in peace, please. physical bell.
We're powering through.
We're going to make it. We have alternatives. We've got $45,000 raise on a $65,000 goal, so we just need to power through and get that last $20,000 in the bank. 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org, or you can donate on the Radio Catskill app.
Oh, and our website, wjffradio.org.
Absolutely. So that's where a lot of folks are going in. So many ways you can donate. So many ways you can keep this community resource going. We know it's a part of your lives. We know that you value it. And when you donate, you're helping keep that thriving and strong for everybody to listen. Now, Kimberly Izar was on the road all day yesterday. She was up in Delaware County covering some stories for Farm and Country, which are coming up later. But the big story she was covering was in the town of Newburgh. The town of Newburgh unanimously voted to oppose an ICE detention warehouse in the town of Newburgh last night. The resolution comes after the federal government quietly leased a warehouse in the town to a Texas-based contractor for $35 million without any local officials' knowledge. Last night, hundreds of people gathered in Newburgh ahead of the town board meeting. Kimberly, you were there, and you're joining us now. Tell us a little bit more about the background before we get into the resolution and what happened last night. When did you first hear about this federal warehouse lease, and what do we know so far?
Yeah, so we found out about it pretty recently. On July 1st, we found out through this public records watchdog group called Project Saltbox. And what they do is they essentially monitor immigration enforcement activities across the country. And so we learned through a myriad of federal records that the Trump administration had leased this 42,000 square foot warehouse to this Texas-based contractor, Leverage Enterprises Incorporated, as you described. The lease is for about 15 years, and it was leased through the General Services Administration, which is the federal agency that's tasked with essentially like managing real estate. Managing real estate. So oftentimes when the federal government leases a warehouse, it's not specifically for ICE or DHS. It's under this broad umbrella of GSA. We also know that this has been in the works for some time. The first, solicitation or federal record that we have of this is actually from 2024, before the Trump administration's second term. And just a little bit about the warehouse. It's located at 800 Corporate Boulevard off of Route 17K, which is just a mile from Stewart International Airport. We've talked about this before, but we know that Stewart International Airport is both a public and a military airport with regular Customs and Border Patrol, you know, services. The desired requirements for the space include a dedicated sallyport for detainee buses and vans, 24/7 government access. They also required an emergency generator and other security measures.
And has ICE or DHS explicitly confirmed they're the ones leasing this warehouse?
They have not. We reached out to ICE when we first heard about it the first week of July. They did not respond to us. We also reached out to the GSA asking very explicitly, is this for ICE purposes? And they kind of just avoided the question, saying that, you know, they're working on fulfilling the mission of the Trump administration's just all of the, you know, things that they're trying to do. Though there are many clues and records that show that this is likely for ICE activities. If you look at a lot of the documents, it explicitly says ICE Newburgh.
And when you found out about this, you reached out to local officials too, and they were surprised.
They were shocked. I reached out to the town of Newburgh supervisor, Gil Piacquadio, and he found out about it just like the rest of us, through the media, through Project Saltbox, through residents calling him, asking him for information. And he said that he didn't receive any information from DHS or ICE. Same with federal officials. Congressmember Pat Ryan actually just launched a petition yesterday saying that he is strongly opposing this, you know, a potential ICE warehouse. And he also reached out to DHS and the Trump administration as a Congress member, and he hasn't gotten any answers. So I think right now we're in this place where a lot of folks are left in the dark and trying to find any information that they can.
You were in Newburgh last night, where hundreds gathered to oppose the potential ICE facility in Orange County. Can you paint a picture of what that looked like and what were attendees saying?
Yeah, I mean, the energy was very alive. It was very lively. There was, you know, several hundred people lining the roads with signs that said ICE out, no ICE in Newburgh, lots of cars honking in support. Here's just a clip of a live band with hundreds of people singing and chanting. And, you know, Tim, as you can hear, the music was very lively and celebratory. But the reason why people were there was really the opposite. You know, a lot of the speakers called for abolishing ICE entirely and demanding that, you know, the town of Newburgh do more. I want to play a clip from one of the speakers. Her name was Desiree Osorio. Her husband was actually detained at Orange County Jail and then eventually deported to Mexico 18 months ago. He's still not back with his family. She and her children are here in Newburgh. She said that she's one of hundreds of families that this has happened to and that she's still waiting for her husband to come back.
No children should have to ask at night, why is my daddy not coming home and you don't know what to say? People ask what separation looks like, what family separation looks like. It looks like my son, when he stopped eating solid food, when he stopped talking. He wasn't making a political statement. He wasn't thinking about immigration policy. He's just a little boy who does not understand why his dad is not home and why his dad never came home. And that's what separation looks like. That's what family separation looks like. And that's why we're here today. And so today, I ask you guys to see us, to see our families, to see our children, to see our fight, to stand with us. And I'm going to ask you one more thing. Don't stop fighting. Don't stop showing up. Our work is not done. Until no child, until no seat is empty at our tables, and until no family member has to wonder if their family, if their loved ones are coming home.
That is Desiree Osorio speaking at a rally before the town of Newburgh board meeting last night in Orange County. Her husband was detained and deported to Mexico, as Kimberly Izar is reporting. She was there last night. Now, tell me about this resolution that was on the agenda for the board meeting for the town of Newburgh.
Yeah, so the town of Newburgh had this resolution on the agenda to oppose the warehouse at 800 Corporate Boulevard, as we described, to be used for a processing or detention center. That was a very specific language. It's not honestly very clear if, let's say, it wasn't used for a detention facility. Let's say it was used for storage or office space, for example, it isn't really clear if the town of Newburgh opposes that. For example, they were very specific about the language. Right before the board, passed the resolution, the town supervisor, Gil Piacquadio, said in his remarks that the town doesn't have the water infrastructure. Let's say it was to become a detention facility, they don't have like the public safety or fire department infrastructure. There is no like There's no restaurants, banks in the immediate area. And so after these remarks, the council unanimously passed the resolution, and there was, a crowd of applause after. But there were several public commentators and other folks that I spoke to who said that this resolution wasn't enough. They wanted the town to pass, more restrictive or prohibitive zoning ordinances, for example, to prohibit, any ICE presence in Newburgh.
And they felt that it wasn't strong enough. It did pass.
It did.
And we mentioned that lawmakers at the federal level, Congressman Pat Ryan against it, issuing a petition for that. What about other lawmakers and officials? What did they say?
Yeah, so actually just yesterday, New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced that she sent a letter to DHS Secretary Mullen, also demanding answers. What's interesting and that she lifted up in her letter is that Newburgh isn't the only place in New York State that is susceptible to growing ICE presence and activity. Also in Rochester and Batavia, they're also looking to expand operations in those areas. So Hochul is seeking more information on that front. But then at the local level, many local officials, including, Piacquadio and many county legislators, have publicly opposed the warehouse. One person who I spoke to was Orange County legislator Genesis Ramos, who said that part of the reason that Orange County is so susceptible to these types of warehouses is because the way that the county has designed how they want to grow their economy. Here is just some of what she told me.
It's been decades of failed leadership that has prioritized warehouses as an economic development strategy and just a development strategy in general. And now we have vacant warehouses throughout the county that have just created fertile ground for us to be targeted by the federal government for these inhumane detention centers. So I think that yesterday it was Chester, today it's Newburgh, tomorrow it could be any other municipality with vacant warehouse.
And of course, this is all coming against the backdrop of shootings of civilians by ICE. An agent shot and killed a man in the city of Biddeford in Maine. It was the second fatal encounter in a week involving an agent and a person in a vehicle. Last week, witnesses say an ICE agent fired a fatal shot into an open passenger window in Houston. What do you think this all says about the Trump administration's immigration policy? The folks in the community, lawmakers at all levels, it seems, pushing back and opposing this.
Yeah, and Tim, I'm happy you mentioned that. That reminds me of one resident I spoke to. His name was Larry Bassett, and he was saying that his granddaughter is starting school, and he's terrified of the idea of an ICE agent or an ICE raid happening nearby a local school, and his granddaughter being hit by, a bullet, for example. What I think this says is, I think we're seeing the local impact of the Trump administration's immigration policy shifting. I mean, just a few months ago, we saw these very public, large-scale ICE raids in Minnesota, right? And even Trump had very public figures like, Greg Bovino and Kristi Noem. Now both of them are out. And the Trump administration also bought, several warehouses that we saw. Even in Pennsylvania, they, I believe, bought a couple with plans to convert them into detention facilities. Now we're seeing this, much quieter behind the scenes tactics that's kind of happening. We're seeing that the Trump administration is trying to offload some of those warehouses, including in Pennsylvania, and local communities are now being like forced to figure out the repercussions of that. And then we're also seeing that the Department of Homeland Security has leased more than 150, you know, other offices and warehouses. Offices and, you know, facilities across the country as they ramp up operations.
There has been an increase in the administration's ICE campaign, their escalated deportation campaign, but it is far less publicized than it was. During a five-day period at the end of June, ICE arrested more than 10,000 people. The figures indicate that while the administration is no longer targeting individual cities in these high-profile campaigns like we saw in the past, these arrests continue and are surging.
Absolutely. And I think, as you described, they're just moving in a little bit more tactfully quieter way. And I think what we're seeing is that Newburgh, a town that like already has the airport infrastructure, that already has an ICE legal office in Newburgh, that already has like that's close to, you know, many major highways, for example, and also has a large immigrant-born population in that area in Orange County, we're kind of seeing that fit pretty clearly into Trump's broader immigration policy.
Kimberly Izar reporting on the activity going on in the town of Newburgh and Orange County, and the continuing story about ICE in multiple places. We've been talking about this. You, again, had spotted the story and jumped on trying to figure out what's going on. And thanks to you, we have more information about what it is. And if you support this type of journalism, we're asking you to donate now to support it during our summer fun drive. Kim's getting in the car and going down there and talking to people and on the scene and seeing these stories before anybody else does, and reaching out to local officials who don't even know what's going on until she called, or are not aware of the activities that are going on,
and talking to residents, our neighbors, our community members, and seeing how they're feeling about something like this coming to the area.
So donate, support the local journalism at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. You can also donate via the app. Kimberly, thank you. And I know we'll be talking more about this.
Thanks, Tim.
More local journalism and local news. A closer look at a congressional amendment that opponents say could threaten the Delaware River Basin's fracking ban and what it could mean for communities across our region. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
When I sit down for an interview, I'm thinking about you. I'm Mary Louise Kelly from NPR. Not every day, but on the best ones, journalists get to ask people in power questions and hold them to account. There is a reason that freedom of the press is enshrined in the Constitution. At home and abroad, leaders make choices that affect your life. Their impulses and decisions need to be examined in as thoughtful and rigorous an interview as possible. Now, journalists don't do this work to score political points. We do it in the service of asking tough questions on your behalf so you and the world can hear the answers, or lack thereof. That is both a privilege and a responsibility. When you donate to this NPR station, you support journalism that does not back down. Here is how to give and how to help public radio hold powerful people to account.
Donate now at wjffradio.org. Thank you.
You are listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Delaware River Basin has been protected from hydraulic fracturing for more than 5 years, but environmental advocates say a proposed amendment in Congress could put that protection at risk. The measure, attached to a federal water infrastructure bill, has raised concerns about the future authority of the Delaware River Basin Commission and what it could mean for the watershed that provides drinking water to millions of people, including folks here in our region and activities along the water in the watershed. To help us understand what's in the proposal and why it's generating so much attention, we're joined live by River Reporter News Editor Liam Mayo. Liam, welcome back.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me back.
And for listeners who haven't been following the story or who don't know about it, because this is sort of like a obscure amendment tucked into a bill that's in committee in Congress, what is this proposed congressional amendment and why has it raised such alarms?
This is something activists have been raising concerns about just sort of over the past couple of days, starting last week. The overall bill that is under discussion is called the Water Resources Development Act. And this is a bill that helps the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers improve the nation's ports and harbors, inland water navigation system, flood and storm risk management, that kind of thing, helping fund projects, infrastructure studies, that kind of thing. And the potential amendment that is raising concern is a bill introduced by the Pennsylvania Representative Scott Perry, Pennsylvania District 10. And the text of that bill would amend the Water Resources Development Act to read, in part, the Delaware River Basin Commission, as well as river basin commissions in Susquehanna and the Potomac River Basin, quote, may not finalize, implement, or enforce any regulation related to hydraulic fracturing that is issued pursuant to any authority other than that of the state in which the regulation is to be implemented or enforced. So taking that out of Congressese, that means that the Delaware River Basin Commission, if this goes through, in theory, couldn't regulate fracking unless the state that the land is in already itself is regulating fracking.
Scott Perry, Congressman Perry, also introduced this Drill Now Act in 2022 and in 2023 and again in February of 2025. Why is it raising such concerns now?
So as of now, it's still unclear sort of where that is in the process. There's not been like recent action saying that this has been voted on or gone through. However, we are now sort of at the point where the Water Resources Development Act is being discussed and edited in the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. There's a markup meeting happening kind of as we speak, actually, this morning. And I think the concern is that this part of the process is where that amendment could be introduced. And as you mentioned, this is something that has been on the table for the past couple of Congresses. This is something Scott Perry has repeatedly introduced to have as an option. But, you know, with the change in administration, the regulatory environment is a little bit different when it comes to regulating fracking than it was 2 years ago. So there's more concern about it. This go around.
The co-sponsor of this bill is Pennsylvania's 8th District Representative, Rob Bresnahan, who represents Wayne and Pike counties. He's a co-sponsor of that bill. What does he say about it?
We reached out to his office and haven't heard back as of this time. Bresnahan has, however, over the time he's been in office, made bringing fracking back to the region one of his priorities. He last year convened a roundtable with pro-fracking advocates in the region, as well as EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin, to sort of talk about the unfairness of Wayne and Pike counties being regulated differently from the rest of Pennsylvania in that respect, where the Delaware River Basin Commission, that ban means that fracking is not permitted in Wayne and Pike counties in Pennsylvania, where it is permitted in the rest of the state. There was a recent letter to a constituent that was sort of shared around talking generally about hydraulic fracturing, where Bresnahan was supporting fracking as playing a critical role in keeping energy prices down and helping the economy of the region. There's this quote from the letter that reads, quote, we must change the narrative on the vilification of domestic energy sources and all of the above energy strategy, including natural gas, renewables like solar and wind and advanced nuclear is essential to ensuring a secure and sustainable energy future. So we haven't heard from him on this bill in particular, but we know in general he's interested in fracking, and we know that he's interested specifically in bringing fracking back to the region, bypassing the DRBC ban.
And we reached out to the DRBC. You reached out to the DRBC. They have declined interviews, but they've issued a statement.
That statement sort of says that they're aware of this proposal and defends sort of their ability to regulate fracking. They specifically say that, you know, if the proposal goes through, it could give favorable status to one industry above all others, and that includes public water supply, energy generation, agriculture, and more. And they also make the case that, you know, this isn't necessarily, or that regulating fracking isn't, you know, on the whole bad for energy generation. They say that the lower Delaware River Basin is a major source of the grid's electricity supply, which does rely on water availability. A major source of withdrawals from the Delaware River goes to energy generation already from other sources. So if their ability to regulate fracking is challenged and fracking comes back into the region in a way that harms the water supply, that could sort of loop back around to harming the abilities region to contribute to providing energy supplies for the nation, rather than kind of being this, you know, universal, oh, fracking is back, now we can, you know, supply more energy thing that advocates for fracking may be putting out.
And to remind folks, the DRBC, the Delaware River Basin Commission, has four states that border the river, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Delaware, who are under the authority of the Delaware River Basin Compact. The four basin state governors are commissioners of the DRBC. And in this statement, the DRBC noted that they all voted unanimously in 2021 to ban water-based high-volume hydraulic fracturing throughout the Delaware River Basin. Following an extensive public process, they say, quote, the decision was based in part on finding that the basin's water supplies were of limited quality, frequently subject to drought conditions, and that action was necessary to avoid injury to the basin's waters. Well, as we speak, that House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure is marking up that WRDA legislation, which includes this amendment. So we'll see what comes out of this. But the Delaware Riverkeeper Network is the advocacy group that's overseeing and protecting the environment of the Delaware River. What are they saying, and who have they targeted on that committee to try to, you know, get some input?
Yeah, we spoke to the Delaware Riverkeeper on Friday, and they said that one of the concerns is with this bill and this amendment is if this amendment gets introduced, right now it's not in the text of the WRDA, but if it does get in there and the committee approves it, that could potentially bypass the ability for the full House of Representatives to vote on this amendment specifically. So when the WRDA goes to the House, rather than the entire House of Representatives getting to vote on this amendment, they would be just voting yay or nay on the bill as a whole, which, again, if the amendment gets introduced and passed, would then be included in that bill. They've been targeting a couple of committee members specifically who represent communities in the watershed or who drink Delaware River water with asking people to call their offices and make their opinions known on this. I think the closest to our area is Representative Pat Ryan, but also Representative Jerry Nadler, who represents New York City, and Representative Nellie Poe, who represents New Jersey. They said they've so far gotten a positive response back from Jerry Nadler, who, while representing New York City, a huge portion of New York City's water does come from the Delaware River watershed. So anything that happens in the Delaware River watershed does kind of affect people well beyond its borders. So
we'll keep an eye on that committee today. That's River Reporter News Editor Liam Mayo. You can read more of his reporting and the entire team's journalism at riverreporter.com. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about the birds and bees and native plants taking center stage at the Calicoon Depot this weekend, and how a day of family-friendly fun is helping build support for the depot's future as a community hub. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hello, I'm Michelle Martin. How's the newspaper where you live? Thin? Getting thinner? Publishing a few days a week, if at all? You're not alone. Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats.
It will sell off more of its daily newspapers.
The largest news organization is shrinking,
laid off nearly a quarter of its newsroom.
and that makes it harder to keep up with our elected officials and what they're doing. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part by keeping NPR and the station strong with a donation today. And we thank you.
Your gift keeps local news, culture, and NPR funded and freely available to the entire community. Give what you can to keep it going. It's so important right now. Donate at wjffradio.org.
You can also call us at 845-482-4141 or go to the app, download the app if you don't have it, and you can donate directly there. Local journalism doesn't happen by accident. It happens because listeners invest in it. And just in the last half hour, you've heard those journalists reporting those stories that are so important to our community. Support that here at Radio Catskill during our summer fun drive. Donate now at 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org, or on the app. And we want to thank Isaac from Calicoon, who donating online. Thank you for your support. And you're listening to Radio Catskill. This Saturday, the historic Calicoon Depot will become a place where people of all ages can explore the connections between native plants, birds, bees, and the environment through hands-on activities, workshops, and demonstrations. It's a free birds and bees event designed to inspire curiosity while supporting the ongoing restoration of the 1896 Depot as a future community gathering place and visitor center. Joining us now is David Krantz, who organized the event. David, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
What inspired this idea for birds and bees at the Calicoon Depot?
Yeah, so I'm the acting program manager for the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway. And as you stated, the depot will be our future home as a visitor center. And I think aside from the fact of us deep down are just a couple bird nerds, that we actually acknowledge a lot of great festivals and events that we celebrate, the Delaware River, Fooder Fest, River Fest, Narrowsburg River Fest. And we thought this was a good chance to let some of the flora and fauna shine. So part of our initiative has always been to increase pollinator habitats and specifically try to bring back the monarch populations. So this was kind of in tangent to that.
I like that. Bird nerd. I want the t-shirt.
Exactly.
So why was it important to center this event around the native plants, birds, and pollinators? You mentioned the efforts to restore some of those in our area.
Yeah. There's always an ongoing battle with invasive plants and insects, and we're seeing a lot of that now with Japanese knotweed along the riverfront. And the more you learn about a lot of this, it has major impact on storm surges, and some of the invasive plants just don't handle soil erosion and water dampening as well as the native plants do, rather, handle soil erosion and water dampening more. And, you know, I think there's an additional component to that that is, There's a financial risk too. There's a lot of ecotourism in this area, and there's an increase in birding, and I think people's connection with the natural environment, a lot of hiking. So this all plays a role in revenue as well.
You mentioned that the event is designed to be hands-on. What are the interactive activities that are going to be happening, and why is that effective for environmental education?
The statistics are there. I think it's something close to a 90% chance of retention rate when learning through experiential education. So I think it's also a good opportunity for to convert some of the youth and to being people that are active participants in these conversations. I vividly remember dissecting an owl pellet in second grade, and I vividly remember the first time of someone opening a bee's nest and hearing the bees hum for the first time. So I think it's important as an educational tool, and some of the hands-on stuff will allow people of all ages, even adults, to bring something home with them. We do have some native seed bombs that will be built, so yeah, we're excited.
And one of the featured project focuses on bird collisions with buildings. How significant is that issue, and what could people at home do to help prevent it?
Shockingly, it's a massive number, and unfortunately, it's over 1 billion birds a year. Wow. That are killed from glass collision, and still that's lower than the number killed by feral cats, which is, you know, a separate topic. But it's really cool. Mara Muller from Sullivan County Audubon Society has been involved with this project, and it's a project across the entire country. Very visual, where these workshops, and we'll have one this weekend, recreate these birds that are all going to be stitched together in this tapestry that's going to tour the country. And it's about the length of a football field, from what I understand. So kind of a cool way to learn about something.
Yeah. I'm shocked to learn how many that is, that number. Yeah.
Wild. Oh, and then, I think she's going to supply some techniques as well as some transparent films that can help reduce those collisions.
Another activity is a birdhouse design contest. What role will the winning birdhouses play at the depot?
I think it was a fun and kitschy way for the depot to be involved and get some of the community's members to get energized about the contest. And I think some of that is the bigger picture of this is hopefully creating something that becomes annual and kind of, you know, starts to slowly build over time. I could see the contest just getting a little more intricate each year.
And you mentioned, you know, the seed ball workshops, owl pellet dissections, there's going to be honey tastings. What do you hope people, especially kids, take away from these experiences and events at the Birds and Bee activity event?
Yeah, I think it's imperative that we mobilize the youth and give them the skills to try to help battle some of the issues we have now and maybe some of the issues we don't know. You know, you read some of the statistics with the pollinators and the implications of that on the birds is massive. So I think it is very purposeful that we do cater to the kids, and we're going to have two booths dedicated to various kid activities this weekend.
And let's remind folks about the event, when it's happening, and then if I wanted to enter that birdhouse contest, what do I have to do?
Yeah, so getting close, you're going to have to work quick, but you can go to the Calicoon Depot, Inc. Website. There's information there to enter. There's going to be more information on there as well about the event this weekend. It is... I do keep in touch with our social media just in case the weather starts to turn for the worse, but we currently have it planned for 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. on Saturday, and that's right in the center of Calicoon at the train station.
Yeah, keeping an eye on the weather there. The birdhouse design contest entries can be dropped off at the depot on Friday between 1 and 5. Friday. There's more information about that at the Calicoon Depot.org. We've been speaking to David Krantz from the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway, who helped organize this event at the Calicoon Depot, the Birds and Bees event scheduled for Saturday. Let's hope that the weather holds out. David, thank you so much.
Thank you. Do a sun dance.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. All right. After the break, we're going to talk to Haunted Like Human. They're a folk duo, and we're going to talk about their songwriting, storytelling, and why ancient myths still speak to modern life. It's coming up on Radio Chatskill.
Thank you for listening to Radio Catskill. And thank you for being a fan of public radio. We know not everyone is. But despite a handful of detractors and defunders out there, Radio Catskill is reaching more communities than ever before. We're constantly connecting new neighbors to our quality programming, fact-based journalism, and life-saving information. And we're able to keep doing more and more of this good work because of our fans, our friends, our dedicated listeners and supporters who donate at wjffradio.org. Their gift is a statement about the kind of community they want to live in, informed, engaged, and connected. They send a message that trustworthy local news matters, that community connection matters, and that public radio in communities like ours across the country deserves a strong future. Please Be a part of that future today. Give now at wjffradio.org. Thank you.
And we want to thank some other folks donating. We heard from Isaac and Calicoon. Thank you so much. And then also Stephanie from Little Falls, New Jersey. Thank you so much for your donation during our summer fun drive. You can join that community of supporters if you haven't already by calling us at 845-482-4141. You can go to the website and donate, wjffradio.org, or on the Radio Catskill app. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. And based the Nashville duo of Dale Chapman and Cody Clark blend folk and Americana with literary storytelling drawing from mythology, Southern Gothic traditions, and intimate human experiences. Their latest album, American Mythology, explores universal myths as a way of examining modern life and relationships. They're at the Bitter End in the city, New York City today, and then tomorrow they'll be up here at Swan Lake. Joining us now are Dale Chapman and Cody Clark. Welcome.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, and for folks who are just discovering Haunted Like Humid, how do you describe your music? And tell us about that name and where that came from.
Oh, man. I guess I'll probably start. So the music is always, it's based first and foremost in storytelling. My background is very much in writing. Like I've always been a musician of some sort or another, but my real kind of core background was in both prose writing and poetry. And storytelling has always been kind of at the core of me. And Cody has a much more musical background, sounds a little silly, but like he's a conservatory trained man with a degree in classical composition. Like, so it's a really kind of fun coming together of the minds and a really fun pairing that takes on like poetic folk and into that kind of Southern Gothic grit at times. We would love to play in all things sort of like folksy and Americana-y and roots.
Mm-hmm. What draws you to that theme of myths, folklore, which is also so very featured on your newest album, American Mythology?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Yeah, I think, you know, with the focus on our songwriting always being the storytelling, I think we also just tend to have this fascination with old stories. And, you know, you go back to myths, those are some of the oldest intact stories we probably have.
And like, somehow, against all odds, this story that we've been telling for thousands of years, like, still feels at its core so modern and relevant that, like, if you changed a little bit of the set dressing, like, it's a story that we would still be telling today. And I think there's something about the stories that we continue to tell that tells a lot about us as people. And that's always been like a fascinating draw for us.
Yeah, and talk a little bit more about how you modernize those stories in a way, because rather than retelling these ancient myths, you seem to use them as a lens for modern relationships and emotions. Can you talk a little bit about that creative process?
I feel like on our new record, American Mythology, there is one that's just a retelling. We open with Eurydice, which is just an a cappella duet that I feel like is really fitting to just highlight what I think is such a like a beautiful and heartrending story. But when you're really looking at the themes of between mythology and old folk tales and fairy tales and parables and like any story can kind of be cut down to like the key concepts, the sort of like, what's the moral of the story? And those things are really evergreen. And it's really easy to kind of like hold up something like Cassandra, which is the closing track on the record, up to the light and be like, this we can just sort of apply lightly over our current world and see that, you know, no one has listened and here are the consequences. And that's a really straightforward thing. But I think that kind of mining the little nuggets out of the old stories and weaving them into new things is really fun. It's the kind of thing that we let ourselves be more inspired by and not so much bound to. if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And Deal, how does your literary background kind of intersect with all of this?
I feel like that's almost a more fun one for you to talk about, the way that I bring things into the writing process.
Dale is a wordsmith. Dale is a wizard. Dale comes to me with such good ideas for songs. We work collaboratively, but Dale usually comes in with a verse idea or a chorus or something solid for us to start with. And then from there, we will talk sometimes for hours about what the story we're trying to tell is. You know, every detail of the story might not make it into the song, but it's important for us to know the story we're telling in order to get the point we're trying to get across, to make it feel timeless to the listener.
As odd as it is, my degree is essentially in editing. And I feel like that shows a lot. Like, if anybody was a fly on the wall for our writing process, like, we sit down and we don't leave it alone until it's right. Like, in the process, you end up putting in, like, okay, this line is like 75% there. We're going to put it in as like the placeholder so that we remember what we're trying to get at. But we're not going to let it rest until it's right. That, like, kind of, I feel like that editorial eye that I bring is also a really strong one. Like,
sometimes we'll rework a single line over and over again, you know, over the course of a year until we really are happy enough with it. Mm-hmm. We don't want to leave that temporary 75% there. We never want to leave that line in a song. So we just keep coming back to it until we're happy with it.
Which I think might be making us sound a little kind of lame and hoity-toity. And that's not the case.
No, we
have a lot of fun with it.
You care. You care very much.
I care a lot, yeah.
Well, and also, you know, folk music has always been a way of passing down stories and storytelling and, you know, making sure that these myths and this imagery goes from one generation to the next. Do you see yourselves as continuing that tradition in your music?
Like, in a way, absolutely. It's something that we're keenly aware of. Like, I've talked in a number of places over the years about how, like, the modern human has almost always come together and shared stories and figured out how to, like, make music. You know, we find evidence of instruments as old as, like, 40,000 years. Like, it is something that is ingrained in the human experience to, like, find community through those things. And it's like, it's kind of an honor to get to play a part in continuing that. You know, sometimes the stories that we tell are about what it's like to be in a long distance relationship and the logistics of that and it being kind of silly. And sometimes it's a nod to these sweeping epics that have been told for thousands of years. But it's something that we are, like, keenly aware of and really, really appreciate.
You're out on the road. I mentioned you're in the city at the Bitter End tonight in Manhattan. And then tomorrow you'll be up in our neck of the woods at Angie's Briscoe Junction and Swan Lake. Is there a particular song that you are surprised by with how audiences respond to it when you're performing live?
Ooh, that might take a second. I know that I have a knee-jerk answer, but I kind of want to know what yours is, Cody.
Gosh, I'm trying to think of one for the new record.
You want me to go first?
The ones that always surprise me are the, like, super personal songs that, like, feel like they're too personal for people to possibly relate to, and then somehow they're more relatable than
anything else.
You know,
the ones that we've... Which is, like, kind of the point, you know, that we've been talking about. I know that one in particular on the record that surprised me was Hangman's Song, which, like, I knew that people would enjoy, but I thought would be kind of a deeper cut on the record and has very quickly become a fan favorite and, like, outstreams a lot of the singles, which obviously isn't the end-all be-all metric, but it's the easiest way for us to see what fans are connecting with. But I joke that it's a cowboy song. it's set up around this sort of it's honestly, to be quite candid with you, the vibe is very heavily inspired by Cody's favorite video game, which is Red Dead Redemption 2. it's for anyone who's listening who's not familiar, it's basically Grand Theft Auto, but with cowboys.
So it's not just myths and fables that you're...
No, it's story in all of its senses. There's just some stories that have been around for longer, but you have this protagonist that there's really beautiful stories in that game, but is very like this really wonderful anti-hero that does like all the wrong things for all the right reasons. And I kind of like, I wanted to capture that. And I was like, Cody, do you want to write a cowboy song? Which is like not something that you say casually when you live in Nashville and when you're not a country music artist. And it was a lot of fun, but at times it almost felt silly as we were putting it together. Like maybe we were having too much fun with it. And I never expected how like ravenous some of the fans would be about it.
I think that one specifically, like we had so much fun with, and it, you know, we weren't coming into this with this huge epic story.
It,
to me, I guess it felt a little less deep maybe than some of our songs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the way people have connected with it has been so much fun.
Well, before we go, and on the way out here, I want to play one of the other songs I've got from your album, Lazarus. Is that a song that we can go out on that you folks think folks will connect with?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Excellent choice, Tim.
All right, good. That's the Nashville duo of Cody Clark and Dale Chapman, known as Haunted by Like Human. They will be at Swan Lake tomorrow. There's more information at hauntedlikehuman.com. And we're going to go out on Lazarus by the group. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thank you for having us, Tim.
Thanks.
Oh, Lazarus, tell me about the deep, dark sleep. Does it come quick and kind? Do you feel it creep? Oh, tell me, does the price get paid? Weigh your heart against a feather. Can you make the trade? Oh, can you make the trade? Between the fire and the sky, on the edge.
It's Haunted Like Human and their song Lazarus. Thanks for being here, guys. And before we go, we'll check in on our summer fun drive. Joining me in the studio, our development director, Mimi Bradley. You know more than anyone how we're doing. How are we doing?
Well, I have some exciting news.
Yes.
First, I want to thank Jackie in Monticello, who gave us a donation during your show. And Jackie has put us over the 70% mark.
Hey, Jackie, thank you so much for doing that.
So
amazing.
We have raised $45,000 towards our summer fun drive, but we still have $20,000 to go, listeners.
Yes.
So who out there has not given yet and wants to pick up the phone? 845-482-4141 or go online, wjffradio.org, or the app.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And well, I was going to say, we have allotted that we would finish this up by Friday, but at this rate, we can finish it up today or tomorrow if
Wouldn't
we get there.
Wouldn't that be nice? We're depending on you out there. Come on, give us a call or go on the app. I've actually had a few people say they donated on the app and said it was really easy.
I had a couple people over the weekend tell me I downloaded the app. And thanks to our interns, Rebecca and Olivia, who did a video for that. They are getting reaching people as well to show them how it works. 845-482-4141. WJFFradio.org or on the app. It's how you can support us during our summer fun drive. I'm Tim Bruno. That's it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. We'll be back here tomorrow. And Mimi, thank you so much with
thank
a little
you.
Bit more of Haunted Like Human.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
It's Radio Catskill Summer Fun Drive. Make your donation now on the Radio Catskill app or at wjffradio.org. We need your help to keep local and national news, great music programs, and life-saving information on air in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Give what you can. Give now. Then tell a friend to do the same. Support Radio Catskill at wjffradio.org. Thanks.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. A heat advisory is in effect until 11. It's sunny, breezy, hot outside. There might even be some wildfire smoke causing the sky to get hazy. High of 93, but real field temperatures over 100. Be sure to stay hydrated and check on friends, neighbors, and pets. This is Radio Catskill. On Point is next.